That's awesome. Yeah, I forget about the blank tour because it was like 10 weeks, I think, just UK and Europe. And yeah, we kind of lost our minds on that. So.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
You're listening to Sapnin Podcast.
Sapnin!
Sapnin!
You are listening to episode 258 of Sapnin Podcast featuring myself, Sean Smith, and my good friend, Morgan Richards.
Yes, it's me, Morgan Richards, and this podcast doesn't need to be your dirty little secret. Even though, when he sees my face, it gives Sean hell. It gives Sean hell.
It's not just face, it's the puns as well. It's the puns. It's the puns slightly more than... Do you know what? It's 52-48, like the Brexit vote, for your puns over your face. There you go.
All you got to keep is strong.
And shut up!
Move
Stop
along.
It.
Move along, like I know you do.
If you carry on, I'm going to get some rope and I'm going to end up having you swing. Right, now leave it! Stop it! Jesus, don't get me involved in this shit. I don't want... This week's guest is the lovely, and I mean fucking lovely, lovely, L-O-V-E hyphen... L-double-E, Nicholas Wheeler of All American Reject.
Do you know, one of the first songs I learned on bass, slapping the bass, was Swing Swing, but...
Whoa, take off.
This band is a fucking hit machine. The crossover appeal they have had on pop punk emo kids and mainstream radio films in the 2000s especially was insane. They've soundtracked a lot of moments for people, and Nick is a big part of that. Co-founding The Rejects with Tyson, and that whole first record is just the two of them fastly becoming megastars. There's been a couple of question marks on the status in the last few years, but they've just come off this massive US tour with the likes of Newfound Glory, The Starting Line, Get Up Kids, Motion City Soundtrack, and more. Jesus Christ. And throughout this conversation... We're going to have constant updates on what's going on behind the scenes, their rich history, Nick's life as a songwriting record producer in Nashville, and owning his own wheelhouse studio. This is an episode we've wanted to do for a very, very long time, and you actually toured with this band back in 2012.
Yes. So 2012, there was an arena tour. The Blackout opened, the All-American Rejects were main support, and a band called Blink-182 headlined. Again, not sure what happened to them. But yes, great to have Nick on, great chat. I can't express how lovely he was. Don't know why I thought he'd be anything but lovely, but he was absolutely fucking tremendous. And yeah, we had a great time, like we did on that tour with Blink-182.
Isn't that the one where you had the magic backgrounds, but you could change it to wherever you
wanted? Oh, yes. That's where Blink-182 said to us. We turned up with a cloth background, and they basically looked at us like we'd zoomed in from the 80s, and they were like, no, it's all right. We've got that big LED screen there that you can use. And we were like, all right, cool. Can we put anything on? And they were like, anything you want. So in Nottingham, we had Robin Hood, who was played by, his name?
Kevin Costner?
Kevin Costner, that's right. Yep, we had Kevin Costner as Robin Hood as our backdrop in Nottingham. That said, ye blackout. So anybody who didn't know who we were thought we were called ye blackout. So that's bad advertising, isn't it? That's bad self-promotion. In Liverpool, we had Cilla Black saying, surprise, surprise, it's the blackout. And we came on to the blind date theme. And in Cardiff, we had Tom Jones saying, all right, look out, it's the blackout, or something along those lines. But yeah, getting to watch All American Rejects just play hit after fucking hit every night was fantastic. And then, obviously, Blink-182 was superb. That was the last tour before Tom left. So I don't want to say the blackout and All American Rejects put the final nail in the original Blink-182 coffin. But I think it was Nick's fault. Anyway,
moving on. Well, it's all good now. They're back together. There's all niche references.
What? But
All American Rejects are coming back to the UK for the first time in a decade as one of the main attractions for Slam Dunk Festival 2024. Whoa. Just announced as one of the first wave of bands for next summer's lineup. And again, throughout this conversation, we're going to get loads of little secrets from producing side of his career to certain classic songs to mad moments and just wonderful laughs in between. Before we get into it, though, a little reminder that go and support this podcast here at our Patreon page at patreon.com/sapnin to keep it going each and every week. There's a whole community of people over there that you need to meet. You need to become friends with. Come on. It's the greatest. All sorts of holiday spirits are fast approaching. So get in the mood with your new best friends. patreon.com/sapnin. Share this episode in your Instagram stories and just share it at Sapnin Pod on Instagram and the app forum known as Twitter. But without any further ado, let's get straight on into it. This is Nick Wheeler of the All American Rejects on episode 258 of Sapnin Podcast.
Sapnin!
Sapnin!
He really is a top egg.
Sapnin!
Just kidding.
Well, that was nearly Nick Wheeler of All American Rejects there, but never mind. Thank you very much for listening. It's the shortest one we've ever done, but no, this week's guest is multi-instrumentalist, producer, engineer, and all-round good egg. The lovely Nick Wheeler of All American Rejects. How are you?
Hello. Good. Okay, I'll say it for real. Thapping in you guys.
Thanks so
much for having me. I'm stoked to be here to talk to y'all.
No, a pleasure. Absolute pleasure. We had Cassidy Pope on recently, and she talked very highly of working with you back in the day on a couple of her albums and stuff like that. So it's just nice that we can connect as well, and there's plenty we want to talk to you about. So thanks for taking the time.
Hell yeah, let's do it.
But how are you doing at the moment? Because, you know, between the band and producing and on this mad tour in the States you've just come off of, it seems like you don't have time to breathe, never mind make coffee and music. So what's going on at the moment? How is your day-to-day now? How was that tour? How are you just decompressing from it?
My day today is good. Thank you for asking. I just had some fried cauliflower tacos. They were delectable. No, I'm good. I'm busy. My head's spinning a little bit, especially, you know, I just got back from the first tour that I've been on in 7 years and the first headlining tour that I've done in 11 years. So,
wow.
Parts of it are like riding a bike and you just like kind of dive in and it's exactly how you remember it. And then, I mean, also it's over a decade later. So there's some things that are different too. But I mean, it was awesome. I'm fucking tired. I'm still like kind of settling in and catching up on sleep and doing laundry and all that shit. But I mean, I'm in the studio today working on other stuff. So I'm learning how to multitask and manage all the aspects of what I've gotten myself into over the last few years.
Yeah. Well, what would you say has been the major changes then since you last toured and then did a headline tour, etc.?
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Oh, man. I mean, well, honestly, the biggest change is the crowd is bigger. I don't know how. We didn't really go away. Like, we kept playing shows. Granted, there were things like, you know, festivals and fairs and corporate gigs and shit like that that we would just kind of fly in and fly out of. But last time we played for, like, true fans, I don't remember there being so damn many of them. Like, we didn't know what to expect. Going into this tour, we were like, I don't know if anybody's going to come. Like, this might just kind of be a last hurrah. Let's just try it. Since we all, you know, are agreeing to take the time to do it, let's just do it and see what happens. And like, fuck, like I left that tour with a tattoo commemorating the tour and some really fucking, you know, some old friends and some new friends and some fucking great memories, man. Like it's not just bullshit. And, you know, me placating y'all by saying like, it was probably the most fun I've ever had on tour.
Oh, wow.
And it was fucking dramatic. Like there was something to overcome every day, whether it was on the production side or, you know, just like kind of getting the machine going again, like with the band and with our team and everything. Like there was always something to figure out, a puzzle to put together, a hill to climb. There was always something. But despite all of that, like the shows were fucking outrageous. We loved them. And I tell you what, you mentioned us playing together on the Blink tour. I think on that Blink tour and on pretty much any tour where we would support, we'd probably play 40 minutes, 45 minutes max, and we loved it. I loved it particularly because I could, you know, be showered and like clean by like 8 or 8:30 and go get dinner somewhere. But honestly, this tour, like every night, we couldn't play long enough. Like, unfortunately, when you're playing amphitheaters in the States, there's curfews, whether it's a noise curfew or a union thing, like they make you quit at 11. And that fucking sucks because some nights we were up there for 80, 90 minutes and we could have kept going. So wow. That was a first too. That's how you know we're having fun. Like we don't want to fucking go home or, you know, go to the meet and greet or go to bed or whatever.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to dive into that kind of mentality of the rejects a little bit, because as you said, yeah. It's a kind of a weird place because you guys didn't really go away, but you weren't super active either. I mean, there was a couple of like one-off singles in between the last few mm-hmm. years and everything. But since you've been doing these shows, it seems like you're having so much fun doing this. What is kind of the mentality behind the band at the moment? Is it just like you guys are up for doing stuff if it works, or is it just kind of like now and then? I mean, what's going on with that behind the scenes?
Well, like I said, going into this tour, I don't think we knew what to expect or what would follow. I think we thought we would be underwhelmed. Nobody would come. And we would just go back to our lives, occasionally flying out to play, you know, the fucking Iowa State Fair or some shit. But, you know, you're right. We didn't go away. We didn't do that like breakup thing or hiatus thing. I mean, you know, maybe in hindsight, it would have been smarter to say that because, you know, this could have been even bigger. But, I don't know. One of us could have quit and then come back. I don't know. It just felt like it was time. I mean, we did this when we were a young thing last year, and it's that partly it's the, like the nostalgia cycle, but also like I feel like we're all older and in a great place to approach this in a healthy way. I think after going through the whole record cycle, major label, 18-month tour thing 4 times in a row in the course of, you know, 10, 12 years, whatever that was, I think we were just tired. And I think, you know, maybe we should have taken a hiatus, like I said, but we just stepped back. We're like, okay, let's figure out our lives. That was all of our 20s. Our 20s were for fucking up and having all the experiences. Like we took our 30s to, you know, get our shit together. And now that we're all about 40, we're like, okay, we can reapproach that. And fuck, I'm so glad we did.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just nice to see you guys doing this and just having fun with it. Do you remember how like that first conversation came back up recently of being like, okay, well, I'm up for doing shows. Did anyone in particular reach out, or was it an offer that came in and you all just kind of went, yeah, why not?
Man, I mean, it felt pretty natural and organic the way the conversation came about. It wasn't like we all said, I mean, we all four live in different cities, so we're rarely just like hanging out, shooting the shit unless we're on tour. So I think it was through just multiple conversations, you know, one-on-one with some of the other guys. And after When We Were Young, we did get a new manager. And he brought the idea to the table. And then for the next several months, we were just like, okay, if we do it, what does it look like? Like, who should be on this thing? Also, we don't know if anybody's going to come, so we need other bands that can sell tickets.
I know that for you.
But I mean, in, you know, through there's throwing all kinds of, you know, random shit at the walls, we landed on what I think is what was the perfect lineup for this first Wet Hot All American summer tour, which TM, and hopefully we'll be doing some iteration of it either next year or the following year. So yeah,
nice.
We just don't know. We don't know what it is yet. So open to suggestions.
Okay.
When that lineup came out, I was like, oh, how quick can I get to America? It's too good. Shit.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. Could you possibly bring that to the UK? Or
we talked about it. I don't think we can afford to bring the package and the production to the UK just yet, but we did just announce yesterday that we're getting to come and do Slam Dunk, which yes. that'll be the first time we've been to the UK since, I want to say, we did Slam Dunk in 2014. It was either 13 or 14, and we haven't been since. So I'm fucking stoked.
I've got a question surrounding that, because I don't know if this is true or is just a mad rumor I've heard in between gossip. Is it true that like you guys were banned from coming to the UK for a while?
I can't speak to that. I have let me put it this way. I've never heard of that.
Right. Okay.
I know, like I said, after you know, a decade of writing, recording, touring, and then writing, recording, touring again for, you know, 4 records in a row. And then on, I think it was our 3rd record, we did, I want to say we literally went around the world in less than 80 days, twice. I want to say that was 2009. And I just remember I was always sick, always fucking, couldn't enjoy it. I remember after one of those world trips there, we literally like we left for the UK and then we just kept going around, you know, we kept heading east, you know, Southeast Asia, Australia, Japan. And then we hit Hawaii at the end of it to like celebrate and relax. But I just remember I just had the flu so bad. I just slept the whole time. I remember landing in Hawaii sick as fucking hell. And I got an email. It's like, oh, we have a number one song right now. And like, that's how I got the news. I was like, I honestly don't even fucking care. Like, this sucks. Like,
you know, wow. Well done, boys. Well done. Well done, everyone.
All that to say, it was hard to kind of stop and smell the roses during all of that. So I think we just got burned out on the long, flights, but I live in Nashville now and there's a direct flight to London. I was actually going to come over to the UK, in March of 2020, but you know, we know what happened then.
That actually happened because my band was considering getting back together at that time. So if you believe in God, God literally went, well, Sean's gonna be happy again.
Nobody's allowed out of the house.
Oh God, you tinker.
Yeah, that blows. So,
apologies for that. Yeah, sorry about that. That's on me. That's on me.
That's on you.
Yeah, sorry. But yeah, how's Nashville treating you? How's the producing and recording going?
I love it here. I mean, I've been here almost 9 years now. It doesn't feel like that. It's kind of the first time I moved to a city just for me. Every other time I've moved has been for work, I guess. I tried LA out eventually. I'm from Oklahoma. I stayed there as long as I could, but I did eventually move to LA in 2010. And it wasn't really even convenient like I thought it was going to be. I was still an hour away from the airport because it's fucking Los Angeles. And I still toured all the time and never slept in my own bed. So I was like, what the fuck am I doing here? So I started looking around and I tried out some other places. Nashville seemed to make the most sense because if I got here and it wasn't all that I thought it was cracked up to be, I could still do music stuff. But that wasn't really even the reason for choosing Nashville. I just liked it because it kind of felt the neighborhood that I'm in. It kind of feels like a Brooklyn or like a Silver Lake. Like, it's cool. There's fucking hipsters everywhere. Good coffee, good, you know, restaurants and shit. But it's still kind of feels like where I'm from, but it has, like I said, like good restaurants and like things that are open past 9. So that's, yeah. So
that's nice. Oh, that is a luxury. That is a luxury. Everything closes super early over here, but not, I mean, we hear so many stories about how magic Nashville is in terms of just its music legacy and writing and inspiration and stuff like that. And it sounds like the perfect place to build a studio. I mean, obviously it has this whole country legacy there, but it seems like it's just full with people within the industry and contacts and songwriters and stuff like that. Is that being a big part of being over there is just how musically inclined that place is?
Well, now especially, I've been here almost a decade already. So I've seen it grow a lot and turn into something that's not just a country music machine.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it still is. I mean, if I cross the river into downtown, it's just fucking country music, but I don't have to. Like, there's a lot more music and other genres happening here. People coming here, people visiting here. A lot of the people I work with don't even live in Nashville. They just come to me because it's so centrally located and they like the town. They like the walkability. They like, you know, it's just a cool vibe. And, you know, when I first moved here, I'd only written with one other person my entire life. And I'd done it for 15 years at that point. And I was like, all right, fine. Fuck it. Let's try writing with some other people. And I really enjoyed it. Everybody was really welcoming and it was really collaborative. For the most part, it was a good experience. The kind of clock in, clock out songwriting thing, though, I didn't really connect with. The let's all show up at 11. I don't know how much time we're going to have. Somebody might have to leave at 2:30 to pick up their kids at school or something. Or, you know, like, we're trying to get done by 3 because so-and-so has to get to another writing session they're doing later that day. And then at the end of the day, it's like, oh, we didn't have a second verse. Oh, well, I guess the song will never get finished. Or you have to like kind of step away, decide if you care enough about it to get back together. But by the time everybody has room in their schedule to do so, it's been 2 months. And it's like, do I care about the song that much? Will I care in 2 months? It's a hustle And a lot of people are really good at it. But for me, and especially on the producer side of it, you know, the way I like making records is I just like to live in a project, whether it's one song or whether it's a full album. You know, like when I did that Cassidy Pope record, like that was just the better part of a year. And that was the only thing I worked on. One, it was COVID and, you know, that's what we were doing. That's all we were doing. But two, like that's just what I love to do. I love to go down a rabbit hole, get lost, find some really cool shit. Maybe I'll find some terrible shit too, but we'll sort that out later. And I don't know that I love, and maybe, you know, maybe that's a little old fashioned. I know the industry and the way people are making and consuming music has changed so drastically. But honestly, when it comes to the creativity and the recording and just making the music, I just love living in it. I didn't experience a lot of that when I first moved to Nashville, but now, you know, I built a studio. It's on my property. And if that's what I want to do, I can do it. So I just make sure to, you know, have the time that I can do that. I don't work on a lot of projects each year. You know, the band kind of became a full-time gig again for the past several months. But I think at the end of this year, I will have worked on like 3 records. And that's kept me plenty busy.
Is that process just kind of you seeing who wants to be up for doing that and kind of picking and choosing what ones kind of speak to you or what you think you could offer something extra?
All of the above. I mean, and like I said, it's a hustle here and a lot of people have, you know, they work a lot more hours than I do and they work on a lot more projects than I do at one time. And great for them. That's fucking awesome. And there's a lot of people here that are doing that. And if that's what you want to do, this is a great place to be for that. For me, it's at the end of the day, it's like, do I like this? Do I want to spend as much time as I like spending on a project? Do I want to spend that kind of time on this with these people? You know, I'm in a place in my life where I can be selective like that. And I feel very lucky, very fortunate to be able to do that. But yeah, you know, a lot of people will reach out to me or a lot of people that I've written with in the past, it's turned into, you know, an actual recording project, which is great. That's always the end goal for me, just because my favorite day is the day that we're in here putting up a bunch of microphones and recording music. That's the end goal. So really whatever gets me to that point and where I can enjoy doing that and enjoy the people I'm with, that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah. I always love hearing producers' different takes on what they do in the studio because, you know, you hear stories of some people are just really good engineers, some people are really great at getting in the nitty-gritty of songwriting. What approach do you normally like to take when someone's like, I want you to produce our music? Is it kind of like, are you in it completely? Do you take a step back?
It's a good question. I it is always project-specific. I like to think that I can offer something from the songwriting, from engineering, from playing if need be. And then also just being a good editor and just kind of keeping an artist or a band on the rails and like getting the best result or making sense of all the ideas that they've brought in. You know, some projects have started from, like I said, just writing together and making demos and stuff. And eventually that turns into an EP or a full length record. Other, you know, a project I worked on earlier this year was a band. They already had all the songs written. They just needed a producer and an engineer and somebody to just make them sound like a band. So that was really fun. A project I'm starting here in a couple weeks is a girl that I've been writing with for a long time. Her voice is insane. But I'll be playing everything. So like I'll have to be the band. So that's the other end of the spectrum. That's a lot more of what I'm used to, which is co-writing and then playing everything.
Now that's cool though. I like the fact that it's very mixed and like, you know, your just songwriting experiences now are just kind of completely different. But going from like a band member to producer point of view, I mean, obviously Rejects have worked with some great producers, but two in particular that I've always admired working was Howard Benson and Eric Valentine. I mean, both of them have worked on some of my personal favorite records, from Three Cheers to Sweet Revenge and Tell All Your Friends. Was there anything in particular you picked up from those two, or was there anything while you were in the studio with them and just being like, whoa, this is a bit crazy how they work or how different they are to each other? Because especially Benson, you hear so many random stuff about him.
You do. He is a hoot. You know, I will say, like, we've made four full-length records and worked with four different producers. And yes, I've learned from all four of them what to do and what not to do in the best way. I do have favorite experiences, but it doesn't necessarily have everything to do with the producer. It also has to do with maybe where we were sleeping, you know, when we weren't recording, or the studio itself. You know, we were most comfortable making our fourth record because, you know, and the third one, because there was a budget, it was the late 2000s. We still got, you know, they still spent money on making records. But I mean, the answer is yes. Sorry, I'm going to take my hoodie off. It's getting warm in here, so I don't want all that jingle on my zipper to, there we go. The answer is yes. I learned a lot, especially from Eric Valentine. Because he is so hands-on, and also a lot from Greg Wells and his engineer, Ian. Honestly, I learned a lot from Howard, but I learned more from Mike Plotnikoff, his engineer. Tim O'Hare, who made our first record, he was kind of like Eric. I mean, we didn't have the budget that we had with Eric, but we made the record the same way, which was we went into a studio and Tim did everything. He tuned the drums. He, you know, ran the tape machine. He engineered everything, and then he ended up mixing it as well. Eric did have an engineer, Matt Radosevich, who was a big help as well. But for the most part, Eric was very hands-on, and he did everything. And I relate to that a lot. Maybe it's an ego thing because I've been like in a band and an artist for fucking 25 years. But I'm a bit OCD. I'm a bit of a control freak. I do like at least overseeing everything. I like sitting at the console. I like running the session. I like tuning the drums myself. It's nice when a drummer knows how to do that and comes in and can do it. But
it's rare. It's rare, though. It's rare.
It's rare. Everybody's programming drums these days, so nobody knows how to fucking tune them. So I do like being very hands-on, and I relate to Eric and Tim, especially with that. I will say, though, when I worked with all these great producers and engineers, I was coming in as the artist, as part of the band. And my role in the band is kind of the same, like kind of overseeing the musical side of everything. So I do wish I had had more capacity to learn about the technical side of the recording more while I had those opportunities. I did retain some of that, but again, for the most part, I was more worried about composition and guitar tones, shit like that. But yeah, I mean, I will say, like, I've since gone back to school to fill in some of those holes with like technical shit. But I will say what I learned from making those four records over that decade with those four amazing producers is like an unmatched, like that experience. Not everybody gets that. And they were all unbelievable. And I learned a ton.
Nice. Is there any, well, I'm sure you've got plenty of Howard Benson stories of him just doing mad stuff, but is there one in particular that always comes to mind and you're like, I still can't believe he did that?
He's a quirky dude, man. I mean, I do think he's the kind of guy who, you know, kind of like how I said, I'm a little old fashioned with the way that I approach recording. I think with the dynamic in which he approaches making records might be a little, you don't see it as often anymore. And that is, a lot of people still think this, that drama and all, you know, having things to overcome, you know, like I was saying on the tour, creates great art. So he would try to stir the pot a little bit. I do remember that. But honestly, the stuff that I retain the most from that experience is just like, I was talking about making that record recently, on another podcast, and it was with a guy who had also made a record with Howard Benson, and he reminded me about the Oreo cookie thing, which was he would literally take an Oreo cookie, you know, break it in half, eat the part that didn't have any frosting on it, as you do, get that one out of the way. And then he would just randomly, wherever you were in the studio, I mean, there's guitar picks and shit everywhere, all over a studio. He would pick up a guitar pick without knowing who touched it, who'd put it in their mouths, whatever, and scrape the frosting off the other side of the Oreo and lick it off the guitar pick.
You did, bastard. That was nice. Oh, yuck.
Wow. And he would do so sitting in a chair like this.
Like, nice. Feet on the seat. Knees up.
I don't know if this is a visual only podcast or if people would just be listening to it, but my feet are up in the chair and I'm in a crouched position, like arms on my knees. And he would usually be wearing a black sweatsuit with a Philadelphia Eagles jersey.
Standard uniform.
He definitely had one of those closets where it was the same item of clothing like 20 times, just like Mr. Rogers.
Wow. Imagine if you found out the secret to becoming an incredible producer is licking the germs off a plectrum via Oreo every day.
That might be the secret, man. He might have figured it out. I mean, yeah, he's ingesting all of the germs and the talent from everyone he works with.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I want to get a vibe for the band. Let me lick the flavor off your fingers. Ah.
I will say that was probably the most efficient record making experience we had, because he had such a solid team. He had, like I said, a great engineer with Mike Plotnikoff. He had a guitar tech who was there, you know, chasing down amps and pedals and dialing guitar tones. The couple of days we did drums. I mean, like it only took 2 days to do all the drums. Like we made this whole record. We made the whole record in like 4 weeks, maybe. And that was working 6 days a week, like say like 8 or 10 hour days, like nothing crazy. But yeah, I mean, we just knocked it out. It was a kind of assembly line way of making records. He had a Pro Tools editor, like cleaning up all the tracks as soon as they got recorded in another room, just like chain smoking and editing. He had a great team. And because of that, he's able to make fucking 10 records a year or some shit. So good for him.
He's got it figured out, doesn't he? Apart from how to eat Oreo, he's got everything else figured out.
I mean, yeah, I guess it's the opposite approach to being so hands-on and such a control freak, having to have a part in every step of the process, like an Eric Valentine or like I like to do. I'm not comparing myself to Eric in any other way. That guy is a phenomenon. But yeah, the Howard way is definitely the complete opposite of that.
No, it's crazy to hear all the like behind-the-scenes tidbits and stuff, especially how these records get made.
I love that shit. Just yesterday, we were referencing something in here and we were trying to find a video or a documentary or just anything showing how they made that first Leon Bridges record, because it's such a vibe. And I'm like, did they go into like an old studio and like in Memphis and like do this correct or what? And couldn't find anything. But like, that's the kind of shit I love, is just like, put me in that space and like, show me old pictures. Let me try to imagine what that process was like. And you know what? There's a lot of it that's romanticized. I mean, there's magic when the idea gets delivered from the universe or from wherever it's coming from. But then it's really fucking boring. It's like every other industry, I imagine. It's like, I don't know a lot about film and TV, but I've made a lot of music videos and they're fucking like pulling teeth. Sitting around waiting, there's technical issues, there's troubleshooting, it's hate. But yeah, the tediousness of making records fucking rules, and I love it.
Nice.
Yeah. Even after the magic has come and gone, and it's just like just the nerdy shit. I love it.
If there is going to be a potential future All-American Rejects, would you take the helm as producer, or would you like to hand it over to somebody else so you're not to blame?
I don't...
don't put that evil on me!
That's funny. I mean, you always want to blame somebody. I'll answer your question, but that's a funny thought. Because in the past, yes, there was a producer, there was a label, there was a manager, and there were plenty of people to blame. I don't feel like we ever blamed a producer. I think us, along with the producer, made those records. So if one didn't perform well, like our fourth one, we didn't blame, we blamed the label. We blamed the label. We blamed our manager. Like, we felt like we did our job. Yeah, there were no hits on that record, but we felt like we did our job and we delivered a record we were proud of. And the fact that it didn't perform well, we just, they were the scapegoat. Oh, it must be the label's fault. But no, I mean, we were kind of all to blame on that one, but there, we're discussing how to approach new music. I didn't think this day would ever come. But yeah, we're figuring it out. I mean, we haven't written together since that fourth record, Kids in the Street. So we're figuring out how to do that. We all live in four different cities. I have a studio here. Mike has a studio in Oklahoma. Tyson now lives in Oklahoma, and there's a beautiful studio there that we have a good relationship with. Like, we can make a record, no problem. As far as getting that kind of outside overlord of a producer with a track record in here, we haven't gotten that far yet. We don't even have any songs yet. Yeah. But I don't know. That'll be an interesting conversation. I mean, I do think at this point, what's nice about having a producer in our band is if we had a formula where if the song is there, we know exactly how to record it and what it should sound like, we wouldn't need anybody to come in here and produce the record. I think what we always tried to do, and hopefully we'll continue to do so, is push ourselves and come up with just new ways of doing things, new instrumentation, new arrangements, just new melodic structures. We just try to push ourselves. And I think a producer comes in handy to just keep it on the rails. Like, either say, that's fucking cool, chase that, don't be scared of that, or that's a terrible idea, we should move on. You know what I mean?
Stop that immediately, please.
No, but that's really cool that you guys are exploring and having those conversations about new music. You said there you didn't think that day would ever come. I've seen Tyson say so many times in interviews that he doesn't expect it to be new reject stuff. So yeah, that's really cool. Again, was it just because of everything that's happened lately? You guys are into it, or?
I mean, everybody's excited, especially us. I think that is what we didn't expect. Like I said, we haven't written together since we were 30 and now we're 40. Wow. You know, we all have other shit going on, other stuff we want to pursue, families, etc. It used to be when we would create, that was the only thing we had. Like, we would literally pick up and move to wherever we were making or writing that record and just live there, like, together, shut the world out and live in that. And maybe that's where I get it. It's like, you know how in therapy they always, you know, want to know about your childhood and your family and shit. Like, this is almost like, I feel like making records now, I get from my formative years of making records and living in it. So I think what we didn't expect to ever happen was to be in a place all at the same time to do that again, because that's how we've always done it. But, you know, like I said, people make records differently. People create differently. We all live closer now. Nobody lives in L.A. anymore. So actually, Chris lives in L.A., but he said he's moving back to Oklahoma. I don't know. We'll see. but Tyson and I do live closer together now. And, you know, we're talking about possibly making trips back and forth and just trying it out, seeing where it goes. No pressure, no expectations. But we're excited to explore that. And honestly, we're excited to do more shows and play more shows for fans, not just fucking, you know, yokels at the state fair. And we got to do that a lot more this year. And next year, it looks like we're getting to do it a lot more overseas, starting with Brazil in February and March.
Come to Brazil.
Come to Brazil. never been to any of the other Americas. So I'm stoked about that. And then yeah, next up is the UK. So that'll be a fucking blast.
Come to Newcastle. Yes. Come to Brazil and come to Newcastle. The two most asked for places in the world.
Don't know why, but that's always
you'd think the way the Brazilians go on about come to Brazil, you would swear that they've got like the biggest like rock following in the world. Like you'd think that every band that goes over to Brazil would be playing to 100,000 people the way they go on to like come to Brazil on every post. Every band always gets come to Brazil or come to Newcastle, one of the worst places in
always,
England.
I did always have those concert DVDs that were like Rock in Rio or whatever, like Iron Maiden and Rush, and like I'm sure they do have a huge rock following, but I mean, I don't know. We'll see what happens when we go.
Imagine you go over there and you're like, Jesus Christ, there's a million people have turned up. I can't believe we're this big in Brazil.
I did hear everybody there is really good looking, so that's exciting.
Oh, good. Nice. Like Australia. I found that in Australia.
My God, I fucking love Australia so much.
Oh, me too. Quick funny story about the good looking people in Australia.
Yeah.
When my band were over there last, me, our front of house, sound tech, and our tour manager went to a nightclub, and we walked in and we were the three ugliest people in the room, right? And then I turned around and our tour manager had left, and I phoned him and I was like, Pablo, how come you've left? And he went, Sean, I was the ugliest person in the room. And I was like, nice one, because I am now.
And then I had to leave. I'm leaving, that torch gets passed to you.
But
yeah.
Fucking, yeah. I love Australia. I fucking love Australia. To me, it feels like the best parts of America, Canada, and Britain all smashing together. That's what
that's interesting. Yeah. Yeah, everybody kind of speaks the same language. The food's great. The wine's great. There's beaches everywhere. I do want to see the parts of Australia that you don't get to tour in, though.
Like the middle.
Anywhere in the middle. Is it, I mean, like, because, you know, when people think of the United States, when people overseas think of the United States, they think of Los Angeles, New York, and everything in the middle is, I don't know, just Texas. But nobody knows anything about the middle. Is that just because they haven't been, or is... Like Australia, is there anything in the middle? I don't know. That's probably a really ignorant question, but
I think it's a lot of desert land in the middle.
I feel like it would feel like being on another planet.
And that's why they all kind of live on the edges, really, basically, because the middle is it's massive. It's so vast as well.
Yeah.
And it's just desert. And then that one big rock, I can't remember what it is. Ayers Rock. Yes.
Okay.
There you go.
Is there like agriculture in the middle, like there is in the States, like, or is it literally just fucking desert?
I don't know.
Turn into a completely different podcast right now.
Yeah, it's fine. I like where this is going.
I was going to say it's become a geography lesson with you two. Right?
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
There's going to be Australians listen to this going, fuck, all this is wrong. We're so angry.
Yeah. Yep. Saying, I hope those bands never fucking come to Australia. Fuck those guys.
Tweet at us at Sapling Pod. Tell us how wrong we are about Australia and how it's got a thriving epicenter.
I'm sure it does, and we're just fucking. Well, I'm just the American in the room, so I have an excuse. I'm a dumb American. What's yours?
We got Australian accents, so there we are.
Yeah. There we go.
But no, it is very exciting to see that you guys are looking to do loads more stuff overseas and that you're going to be playing all these shows and whatnot. But taking a trip down memory lane a little bit, and you said throughout about those formative years of songwriting for you, and that first record was just you and Tyson kind of still in school, kind of dropping out and then just kind of going 100% with the band. Like, could you take us back to those times and like, the first ideas of the reject songs and then like getting into the studio and you play multiple instruments? It must seem like, looking back, just like such a wholesome time of not expecting where this band would actually go.
I mean, yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I mean, I guess it's kind of the healthiest attitude to have. Like, you don't have expectations. You don't have pressure. Nobody else is listening or cares. You're just doing it for yourselves. And, when if you're lucky, like we were, and one person who has a record company hears us and does care. That's exciting. That allowed us the ability to go to New York. And even though we were sleeping on the producer's floor and surviving mostly on like tofu dogs, we still got to make a record to tape on a fucking Neve console from the 60s, wow. You know? Yeah, I mean, but again, like, yes, while I appreciated every bit of it, at the same time, it was almost like I felt like we were on a mission to like make this record. And so again, it's kind of, it wasn't a lot of living in the moment and appreciating exactly where we were and what we were getting to do on what we were doing it on. It was just all about the songs and getting the ideas out the way we wanted them to, you know, to sound or be heard. Sorry, I'm just kind of thinking out loud, but yeah, there was no goal. I think the only goal for me was just getting the fuck out of Oklahoma. You know, nobody likes where they, you know, their hometown. Some people end up going back, but for me, I never saw myself staying there. So I kind of wanted to get started on leaving. I dropped out. I grew up in a college town. So I went to college there, while still living at my parents' house. So that's, you know, that's another thing. Like once you graduate high school, if you're still living at your parents' house, which a lot of people have to nowadays, I understand, but, doesn't mean that you want to get out of there faster. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I didn't really get to have the college experience. That didn't come until I was touring. That was my college experience. Yeah. And that was where the debauchery and the fucking up and just the life lessons came in was when I was on tour. I kind of just wanted to get that started. So I found the person that I clicked with creatively and we just buckled down and that's all we did. That's kind of where it started. You know, that's all we did. Tyson even graduated high school early, so he would have more time to write and make a record.
Wow.
I dropped out of college so that I could, you know, sleep till noon and then just make a fucking record. but yeah, I mean, it's very, very selfish and one track minded, but, that's how that first record had to go. We just had to give everything else up and, you know, leave it all behind.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
How complimentary were the two of you in terms of songwriting together back in that day? Like, do you remember one of the first like ideas between one of you brought to the table and the other one went, "Ooh, I've got this that could go with it," or just sparked from
absolutely there? I mean, our relationship has always been very opposite but complimentary. You know, the way that he writes lyrics and forms the thought and then makes it musical is insane. And I don't need to touch that. That's his world. The way that I see a song as a puzzle and approaching it more from a melodic, yes, but more from a musical sense. That's kind of what I bring to the table. And I think that's a really great match. As far as, you know, finishing each other's ideas and whatnot, you know, it's, you know, there might be a spark of an idea that Tyson will bring in, or even a more fleshed out idea sometimes. But it just kind of goes back and forth. And we've usually done that in the same room. A couple songs have been more like, you know, Postal Service style, where we're just kind of sending ideas back and forth. I'm sure there'll be a lot of that if we choose to write some new music. But yeah, back then, there's something magical about being in the same room as somebody, because I remember writing the last song. He was just kind of showing me the chorus while playing the bass. And there's a flat 7 chord in that. Like, he accidentally hit the wrong chord. And he's like, oh shit, sorry. And I was like, no, that's fucking it. Like, that mistake you just made, like, that's a weird chord, but it's fucking cool. Like, that's what we're doing. Just little things like that happen in the room are fucking magical. And then, you know, a lot of times, I like to sit with something and just, like, I keep saying, just kind of go down the rabbit hole with it. So creating that first record, especially, there would be a lot of, we would kind of have an outline for a song, maybe a melody. And then, you know, Tyson would be in school the next day. I'd already dropped out at this point. So I would just be sitting at home with my desktop Dell computer is what I was recording on at that time, with Cakewalk 7 or 8. And I would just throw a bunch of ideas down, and then Tyson would come over afterwards. I'm like, what do you think for like the vibe of the song? And then we just kind of go from there.
Wow. Oh, I love that.
Super cool.
While we're on that timeline as well, the video for Swing Swing used to get played a lot on Kerrang! Yeah. Over here, so much. It probably still does, but especially when I was watching
Yeah,
regularly,
Kerrang! Fuck
it.
Yeah.
Used to be on repeat. But I learned recently that you actually shot a completely different video for that, very much lower budget. But it never came out. Like, how close was it being gonna put that out before you got like the proper budget to do the video that we all have seen and know?
I'd like to say it never got even close to coming out.
Ooh, okay.
I can't say for certain. I just know that we kind of did it ourselves. Tim, our producer's girlfriend at the time, helped us make it. We didn't really have an identity for the band yet. You know, we just had the songs, and we were just a couple kids in fucking t-shirts and jeans and Converse. And I think when we made a video, we were like, do we need to like dress nice? Like, what do we even, what do we do in a video? So we made this silly video that had, there was a storyline, and there was like a love interest, I think. I don't remember too much about that, but I do remember the performance. I was wearing like some shiny shirt tucked into some slacks. We looked like the fucking Click 5 or something, but there was no budget. Like, we did this all ourselves with Tim's girlfriend. But we just like one afternoon got like one of those photo studios that had like a white wall set up. You know, I played guitar in some scenes, Tyson sang and played bass, and then I played drums in some scenes, and then we played together. It looked really weird. We tried to make two guys look like a whole band. It was ridiculous. But between just the weird, is it two guys or is it four? Why are their shirts so shiny? But between all of that, I think the label Doghouse was like, yeah, I'm glad you had fun doing this, but nah. And then once we moved the record over to DreamWorks, and there was an actual video budget and a great director attached, Marco Siega, I think it was like, all right, let's put the shiny shirts away, put the Converse and the fucking t-shirts back on, just fucking be yourselves. And that was what was so ironic. I feel like we were on an indie label making a low budget video, trying to make it look like a fancy video.
Yeah.
And then once there was, you know, $100,000 to work with to make a video on DreamWorks, they were just like, I don't know, just fucking wear whatever you have on when you get there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was honestly just be yourselves, fucking four kids from Oklahoma playing in a fucking dirt lot.
I like the idea of the label going, seeing the second video, second version of Swing Swing, and going, oh, I thought you were just a pair of, you two pairs of twins, but now you're not. Oh, you've got other people in the band. Oh, that makes sense. Okay.
I thought you were two pairs of twins that dressed alike. Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Another thing I've always wanted to ask, the guitar solo in Gives You Hell.
Yeah.
The genius discordant note. Who came up with that? Who was?
Oh, yeah.
Because the first time I heard it, it literally stopped me walking. I was like, what's that meant to happen?
It's that minor third that just gradually bends and you hope will finally get there, but it doesn't.
I love it.
No, that was me. That's just one of those. That's one of those examples of like, that's what's great about the relationship Tyson and I have when we're writing, is that you have somebody immediately to be like, okay, I just did something. I think I love it, but I might hate it. I don't know. What do you think? And you know, kind of like I was saying with the last song, like, I played it and he was like, I mean, yeah, that totally makes sense. It sounds like the song is supposed to sound. And I'm like, okay. And then with something as fucking weird and quirky as that, I feel like you really have to lean into it. My lamp just turned off because the motion sensor went out. Hang on.
Ooh.
There we go. All right.
None of that.
I've been sitting here too long. So my motion sensor thought I left.
Apologies.
No, I wasn't saying I need to get out of here.
The lamp's turned back on.
But you know, then I think you really got to lean into stuff like that. So when we did go into the studio with Eric Valentine to make that record, I had just seen the there was a series on VH1 that they now you have to buy the DVDs of them, but it was called Classic Albums, where they would have an artist, usually a huge artist, go in, sit at the console and solo various instruments or parts of a record and talk about it. Fucking fascinating show for people like me who love nerdy shit like that. But I remember seeing the one for Night at the Opera by Queen. And there's a song called Lazin' on a Sunday Afternoon, I think it was called, where the vocal sound is an empty paint can, pair of headphones thrown in, and then Freddie's off in another room singing. But the sound that they use on the record is not his direct vocal into a microphone. It's a microphone in a paint can recording sound coming out of those headphones.
Wow.
And it's fucking fascinating. So that's kind of what we did for the Gives You Hell guitar tone. I remember we're just kind of like, we're like, where the fuck did Eric go? We're just in the control room, like, what the fuck is going on? And then he is just extra in every way, technically speaking. He doesn't have any glass in the control room. You cannot see into the live room from the control room because he just wants it fully insulated, fully isolated from the rest of the studio. So he had this like a security camera thing where you could like switch between the various rooms in the studio as well as the parking lot. The parking lot happened to be the image on the screen. And we're like, is that it? Is he outside? What is he doing? Oh, he's emptying a paint can in the fucking parking lot. So yeah, we kind of tried to do something similar just to get that weird hollow kind of like coming out of a radio, like an old-timey radio kind of thing. That's the other thing about making records now, man. There's a plugin, there's a fucking preset for that.
I was just going to say, yeah.
But it's so much cooler to fucking empty a paint can, throw some headphones in it and fucking mic that.
But how much cooler is it to be the guy who brings out the new plugins that are paint can based? You should look into that, Nick. Yeah, you should look into that. You could be the leader in the weird plugins added. Yeah. Oh, the mind is racing. I'm off.
TM.
Yeah, that, and then just get the bike sound that John Feldman loves to put on used records as well, and then you're sorted.
Oh, what is that secret?
Oh, he's just, yeah, there's one of the used songs where John Feldman, for some reason, decided instead of drums and percussion, let's just use the sound of a bike being peddled, like you do. And it works. Of course it works.
Does it have like that brrrr kind of like sound?
Yeah. You can kind of hear the chain and the pedals or whatever.
Yeah. That's fucking interesting. I love that shit. That's super creative. And that's, it's organic, but then you can fuck it up with whatever you want. Like, it's so fun to find shit like that or think of shit like that. And I try to do that here. It makes the process of making records extremely slow and inefficient. But honestly, like that's where the actual magic is, I feel.
I remember the first time I saw the Used recording their first record with John. I saw a video of Bert was in a tunnel, and I remember being shocked because like my band had done our first record and we'd done it like in a guy's basically house and we were just in the studio solidly. But then I saw like Bert McCracken with an SM7 and a Mac just in a tunnel recording a vocal, and I was like, you can do that.
That's fucking
So I just remember seeing all those ways of recording and being blown away, like, I never thought of that. I never didn't realize we were allowed.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have to be like a $10,000, you know, German microphone in a immaculate studio. I mean, I would prefer it to be that because that's just an amazing experience to have. But you know, I forget what record we were making. I just remember doing a mic shootout and Tyson just wanting to sing on like the most esoteric, like dinosaur looking microphone, just to, you know, to sing into that and look at that for several hours. But we ended up using the SM7 because it sounded better. And actually, when we were making When the World Comes Down, we did go a little stir crazy in Eric's studio. We were there for 9 months recording that record because we did all the tape. We did all the tape too. So Eric is tedious and very detail oriented in the best way. But a band can kind of go stir crazy, you know, being like, what did we do today? Oh, we figured out the snare sound for one song. Or what did we do today? Oh, we did two guitar overdubs. That can get a little old. So we did mix it up and we went to Atlanta to a space that we were familiar with, a space that we ended up writing some of the record. We wrote some of Move Along there. Anyway, it doesn't matter. There was some vocals that still needed to be recorded. And Eric literally had a, you know, an interface and maybe a couple mic pre's or something. His vocal chain set up on a card table in a fucking shitty plywood rehearsal room. And Tyson had an SM7 on a mic stand. And then he literally wrapped himself up in a curtain. So it was to isolate himself and to not have any reflections from this horribly treated room.
Wow.
And that's how we recorded some of the vocals on When the World Comes Down. Like,
yes, with a big cape. Yes.
Yeah. Curtain cape. Oh, see, this is the stories we love. This is the stories we love. Speaking of Eric Valentine, there's obviously another Taken Back Sunday-ish connection with The Reject and the fact that you had Matt Robbano playing you for quite a few years live.
yeah, Matt's awesome.
I bring this up because we're good friends with Matt and we've had him on the podcast before and everything, but we talked so much about other aspects of his career. We didn't dive into his Reject experience as much as I would have liked to. But I was just wondering, like, was there ever a point when he was playing with you where you guys thought like, oh, maybe he was, you know, you want to keep him in the band full time or recording with you guys? Or was it just kind of like a live experience in at the time needed someone to come out on the road?
I don't think we were ever seeing it. You know, if there was a permanence there, it would have been more of a live thing. And that's nothing against Matt. He's an incendiary bass player. You know, I mean, our singer plays bass, so try taking the bass away from the singer.
That's all about, yeah. But
no, honestly, because Tyson is a vocalist, his bass lines are very melodic and very creative, and it's not just the dude playing the root notes. You know what I mean? So I do love Tyson's instincts for those bass lines, and you know, I'm sure Matt is good enough to where he could put himself in that headspace and come up with something similar. It was always just more of a live thing, I think. And he played with us while we toured Kids in the Street, he probably would have been at that show in Wales that we played with Blink in 2012. Yeah, and then there was no music after that for several years. So at that point, Matt had moved on. We weren't playing as many shows. Honestly, we never even got to the point where that would have been a conversation we had. But I think we always looked at it as a, hey, Tyson doesn't want to be tied down, you know, to a mic stand playing the bass on every single song in the set. He wants to, you know, go be a lead singer a little bit and a front man. So, you know, we started dabbling with that a little bit on the third record. And then once Matt came on, I remember every night he would just be playing more and more songs and Tyson would go do his thing.
He's a good egg, our Matt. Hell yeah. He's a lovely, lovely boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know that he played on a Shaq record? He played on one of the early hip hop records, the Shaquille O'Neal brought out.
Shaquille O'Neal.
I don't doubt it. I'm more surprised. I'm less surprised about that fact than I am the fact that Shaq just has a record at all. That's incredible.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh yeah, yeah. That shocked me as well. I didn't realize that, but yeah, you know.
Well, the thing is, he brought one out years and years ago that Matt Rubano played on, and I think he's bringing out material lately as well. He started rapping again. He started singing his rap songs again. Well, so
Shaq
look
has?
Out for that. Yeah, yeah. Have a look. So he does DJ Diesel, where he goes out and DJs dubstep, which is mad. Because like, imagine going to a festival and then you just look up to the DJ and it's 200-foot giant man, Shaquille O'Neal, just headbanging to dubstep.
I've seen like those memes where it's like Shaq in his kitchen, like DJing for his kids.
Yeah. He loves it.
Then they'll put like Owl City or something like hilarious yeah. over it. And it's like kids are going off like, hell yeah. I've seen that. I didn't know it was an actual thing that he went and did in public though.
Oh yeah. He goes to all the big EDM events and DJs there. It's crazy.
Oh,
it's mental.
I can't wait for the All American Reject Shaquille O'Neal tour coming soon.
Well, dude,
let's get a collab going as the kids say now. Yeah.
Finally, All American Rejects Shaquille O'Neal.
Featuring Shaquille O'Neal or vice versa. Honestly, I think it should go the other way around.
Oh, that'd be amazing. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Nick, as we start to wind down this conversation a little bit, I really appreciate all the honesty and stories you've shared with us. But I mean, you know, throughout you've said how much of the Machine Rejects is being in that kind of touring cycle and just constantly being on the road in between records in that time. And is there any memories that stick out from that you think, like, when you get to dissect it a little bit now, that are just like, oh my God, the fact that we got to do that was crazy? Or being any circumstances that you just kind of look back on and just amazed by?
I mean, yeah, there's plenty of things that there's probably tons of things I don't even remember that happened. Just because, you know, the other day we were sitting down and we were actually looking at our tour schedule from the first 10 years of our career and how ridiculous it was. There was a lot of traveling and I saw a lot of shit in a short amount of time. I literally getting to like see the world and, you know, fucking go to Stonehenge and, I don't know, go to Australia multiple times in a single year. Who fucking does that? You know, there, of course there's like little things like, because I happened to get lucky and be in a successful band in the early 2000s, I got to, you know, interview Def Leppard for a metal magazine.
Like, wow. Nice.
Which, you know, they're, you know, they were and always will be like the most influential, just formative band for me. So like, I got to do that when I was like 21, like that's ridiculous.
That's class. Yeah, that's awesome.
But, you know, just of course, there's like little things like that. And, you know, people you run into, people you meet, whatever, you know, just because I live in Nashville and I have dogs, I met Steven Tyler at Baggage Claim because our dogs happened to like,
what?
Like, wow. Want to meet each other, like just random shit like that. You know, and as I get older and as I'm home a lot more now, less and less of that stuff happens. But just there's a million little anecdotes like that I can share, but I mean, just the overall experience and getting to do what what I did, how I spent my 20s, like, was, it's fucking insane. And yeah, I mean, yeah, it's one of those things where fortunately, I feel like in those earlier days, those memories are easier to recall because there were a lot of firsts, you know, just like you always remember your first time. Like, I remember I had a lot of firsts. And those are what I'm going to remember. As we started repeating things, and like I said, going to the same place multiple times, sometimes in the same year, kind of start forgetting or not remembering them as well, or being like, wait, what country were we in when that happened? Or which time was that? Fortunately, because, you know, I'm sure you can relate, when you're in a band and you're making records, I don't think, you know, if you say 2008, I don't think, oh, I was 26. I think, oh, 2008, that was when we were recording our third record and we were at Eric Valentine's place 7 days a week for 9 months. Like, that's how I kind of compartmentalize time in history. You know what I mean? So all of those years are going to be blocked off like that. 2013, 14, though, I don't fucking know what happened those years. Because the band didn't do anything those 2 years. So they're just a blur. 15, I moved to Nashville, but then 16, 17, 18, I don't fucking know. So yeah, I mean, I just feel fortunate, and everything I got, I've gotten to do. And, you know, now hopefully there'll be some new memories and new experiences now that, you know, the band is getting busier and I'll be, you know, leaving the house again. But yeah, it's always a pleasure to, like, look back on that stuff and talk about experiences, especially when it relates to, you know, record making, or just sometimes I probably get a little too inside baseball with, is that even a term in the UK?
No, we get it.
Speaking on
the US
shows.
Yeah, we get it.
I haven't used that term before, but I've heard it a lot. So I thought I'd try it on. And I was like, talk about baseball on a podcast with the UK. All right, that's fucking silly. But sometimes I can get a little too nerdy with it. But just talking about whether it's with history or memories or record making and how it relates to just where I'm at now, or even just getting to look back on it with actual perspective. Cause when you're talking about doing that shit while you're doing it, it just sounds like you're bragging. And I don't mean to sound like that way. I don't mean to sound like that way right now either. Like, I've got to do a lot of cool shit and I can't say any of it without feeling like I'm being like
snap.
Yeah. Without being like sleazy. But yeah, like actually being an adult and being able to look back on that shit more objectively and being like, that was fucking stupid. Or like, I can't believe I got to do that. Like, that's always fun. And that's a great exercise. So thanks for allowing me to do that.
No, honestly, pleasure is all. I was wanting to hear these stories for so long. So thank you for sharing them. Thank you for just continuing to keeping this thing alive as well. I'm so excited that you guys are coming back to the UK for Slam Dunk. And
we can't wait to see
what's going on.
I haven't been on a flight longer than 4 hours in a very long time. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I'm going to start downloading some shit on Netflix now. So
nice. Yeah. We got different Netflix over here as well. Yeah. So, and I've just realized how inside baseball, the term inside baseball is coming from an American to a UK. Yes. On me. The irony of inside baseball is not lost on me.
I knew
absolutely it. Brilliant. But yeah, this has been absolutely fantastic. Super, super good. Thank you so much for this, Nick.
My pleasure.
I've really, really, really enjoyed myself. So appreciate this very, very much. Thank you.
Likewise. Appreciate y'all.
You're listening to Sapping Podcast!
Yes!
Woo!
That was the beautiful Nicholas Wheeler of All American Rejects, the creator of my favorite guitar note in a song. That fucking discordant note or whatever it is in Gives You Hell is fucking genius. It's so good. I love it. I remember the first time I heard it, I was in complete shock. I was like, ah? What? Ah? I love it. I love it. But nothing's better than one of them rock discos that I sometimes DJ at, playing that song or watching people doing the guitar solo, and they always make a face, which you can't see on an audio podcast.
No, but you
can't.
Imagine
me with a more distorted face than usual. Oh, God. Good God, no. But yeah, that's what it's like anyway. But yes, thank you very much to Nick and his team for sorting it out, and All American Rejects for existing and giving us some fucking brilliant songs.
Absolutely brilliant songs. You mentioned those nightclub discos. The amount of their hits that get played constantly over here.
To this day.
It's great. They're always a bloody sing-along. I'm so happy that the band are back doing stuff, maybe making some new music and coming back to the UK for Slam Dunk 2024. I'm definitely going to be down the front singing along. It's just funny how this industry works. And again, another prime example of it being such a small world and everyone being friends with the links between them and Matt Rubano and Cassidy Pope and us. Everyone's just, I love it. I love how it's just one giant happy emo family in a lot of ways.
Yes. I was going to say inbred fuckfest, but no, you are right.
Yeah. So my phrase is probably a bit better. I don't know.
Yeah.
You also get more headlines.
But mine's
just like maybe a bit more.
So I'm the clickbait. You're the actual journalist. There you go. That's what it is, isn't it?
Who knows? Who knows? Speaking of emo throwbacks and people on this podcast, awful segue, but you're going to be supporting a classic band that we all love.
Don't say classic. Cardiff. Don't say okay. Classic because I'm
timeless. Timeless. Timeless band?
We're supporting the fucking Mighty Finch. On Monday, November the 6th, we are supporting, my band Raiders are opening up for Finch and another band at the Tram Shed in Cardiff. I cannot wait. I hate the idea of it. All of our bands now being classic rock, because that makes me feel sick inside. But yes, we're supporting Finch, who are celebrating the 20th anniversary of their first record, What It Is to Burn. And it's a fucking good one. I cannot wait.
Very, very nice. If you're in the UK, make sure to head over to Raiders social media pages, which are
at Raiders Band UK on Instagram, X, and what?
For the updates on that and how you can get your tickets. And keep an eye on everything to do with the podcast at Saffron Pod on those same platforms because we've got so much stuff going on. And if you're a member of our Patreon community, patreon.com/Saffron, you might have heard of us trying to get some merch together or maybe celebrate something soon as well. So, you know, come and join the party if there is one and come and just get involved with this wonderful community. And
do
speaking
it.
Of
come
them,
on.
If you head to the description of this episode, there's loads of names there that we thank. And as always, Sean is going to give them a massive shout out to the elite members of our Saffron Podcast Patreon community. Those are the lovely people in the top tiers.
Yes, they are as follows. Thank you very much, and get well soon to Kylie Wheeler. Thank you very much, Mayumi, Janelle Caston, Paul Hirschfield, Tony Michael, Dilly Califragilistic, XBL, Grimwood, Kelly Irwin, Scarlett Charlton, Natasha Morris, Emma Barber, Mitch Perry, Nathan Croshaw, Nathan White, Amy Louise, Alexandra Pemblinton, Kate Besant, Molly Malloy and James Bowerbank, Jonathan Gutierrez. I still haven't tried that bloody coffee. Thank you very much, Jenny Robinson, Murray Grimwood, Scott Jones, Amy Dawson, Stuart McNaught, Ellen Southfield, Stephen Aston, Caroline Robson, Kate Patrick, Martina McManus, Louis Cook, Carl Pendlebury, Danny Eaton, James McNaught, Jenny Munster, Jason Aredia, John and Emma, M. Evans-Roberts, Craig Harris, Evan, Sean Foynes, Vicky, Emily Perry, Adam King of the Goths Parslow, Kalila Keane, Ollie Amesbury, Josh to the Europe of the Two Thieves who stole a calendar. They each got 6 months crisp. That's the same as last week's. Thank you very much, Kyle David-Smith and Connor Lewins and family. And also I want to give a shout out to Brett and Steph. My friends who are getting married this weekend. So,
Yay, love and all that. We should probably give a shout out that two members of our Patreon who met in the Patreon are now engaged.
Yeah. Yes, they are. Well, who'd have fucking thought? Yes, well done, Lucy and Paul. Well done, Paul, on somehow persuading Lucy to say yes. I don't know how you managed it. Must have been a bribery.
Bringing people together. Patreon.com/Saffron.
No, that fucking singing we not. Anyway, yes, that's it. This was a great episode. Cheers, Nick. Cheers, All American Rejects. Cheers, Morgan. Cheers, everyone. Sapnik!
Sapnik!
Yeah, now. I'm having a stroke, I think. Could you smell toast?
You're listening to Sapnin Podcast with Sean Smith and Morgan Richards. Thank you very much for downloading this podcast or streaming it, or I don't know what else you do with podcasts. Thank you very much.